And if you are a child here, if you'd like to go to your classes now, and the teachers as well, and there is a creche for toddlers available, so just through the doors there. We're going to turn to Acts chapter 27. Now, as Dave mentioned, it's Kathleen's Thanksgiving service tomorrow. And we have mentioned to wear colours, and that is the case. But just wants to emphasise, that maybe wear muted colours for this Thanksgiving service. Maybe not Hawaiian colours. So, colours but muted colours. If you want to wear Hawaiian colours, come to our men's meal on Thursday. And that being said, it's great to see David Collingwood here arriving just to come to the men's meal. So that's commitment, isn't it? So it's good to see David. And just to mention for the funeral service as well, toward the end of the Thanksgiving service, what we're going to do is to sing a benediction, to sing a blessing together. Now, it's not going to be familiar to a lot of us, so we're going to practice that this morning. So after Owain's led the prayer time and the Lord's table, at the very end, we're going to practice that benediction together. So just to warn you of that. Now, we're going to look at Acts 27 now. Now, it's a long chapter, so just brace yourself. And what we're going to do is we're going to read it in sections. I'm going to read a paragraph or two, and then I'm going to explain a few of those verses. So it would really help me. It would more so help yourself to have the Bible in front of you. So if you need a Bible, Phil's at the back. So don't be ashamed to put up your hand to say, actually, yeah, I do need a Bible. So there you go. So Phil's got a few copies. So it would really be helpful if you have that text in front of you. And throughout this chapter now, we're going to be looking at some, foreign topics. Foreign topics in the sense, we're looking at different countries firstly, so they're foreign. But foreign topics because a lot of us here probably won't know too much about nautical language in terms of sailing or boating kind of type language. I didn't. I remember actually when I went to France on a school trip, one of the activities one day was sailing. Yes, I went to a posh school. One of the things is they said to pair up with someone who's been sailing before, hadn't been sailing before. So I went paired up with someone who has been sailing before, and it turns out they had been sailing before, but they hadn't done anything while they'd been sailing. So out there on the open water, I don't think I've ever felt so useless and terrified all my life. I'm not familiar with a lot of the words that we see here. You know, verse 16, we pass to Lee. Well, Lee's sitting over there, but I don't know, what does Pastor Lee mean? Run aground on the sandbars. What was the sandbars, verse 17? Dropped four anchors from the stern. I kind of know what that means, but there's a lot of language here I don't get. Hoisted the foresail, verse 30. And again, I know what a sail is. It's that big bed sheet you hang over the boat, isn't it? The foresail, I'm not sure what that is. So let me tell you, this week has been a battle in the study, I'll tell you that. So I know what the big picture is. I know what the big picture is. Paul's on a boat trying to get to Rome. He's been shipwrecked. I understand the big picture because the Jesus story Bible tells me. There's pictures of it there as well. It's great. But with the details of this passage, I just get a little bit lost. So like all top level researchers do these days, I've been on Wikipedia this week trying to look at what the details mean. And the other strange thing to us might be the geography. And we've got all these place names, and being dyslexic, I'm really looking forward to pronouncing them. And so what we're going to do, as I mentioned, we're going to look at this long chapter in stages. I'll read a paragraph or two and then explain it. And so it will take us a bit to get through, but do not fear, I've planned accordingly. And then at the end, we're going to ask, why is this story here? What's the one big thing this story is trying to tell us? Okay, so let's get into it. That's enough of me talking. Let's get into God's word. Verse 1 of Acts 27. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship from Antrimidium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. We put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed in Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so that they would provide for his needs. From there, we put out to sea again and passed to the lee, I don't know what that means, of Cyprus, because of the winds were against us. When we sailed across the open sea of the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off Sinus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee, again, of Crete, opposite Salmon. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. So, I mean, wow, there's just a lot in those verses there, isn't it? So Paul's been linked now. So Paul's been on trial and he's going to go to Caesar in Rome. And he's been linked now with this Roman centurion called Julius. And of course, a centurion's in charge of how many people? Actually 80. So you would think it would be 100, but it's between kind of like 80 and 100-ish. And he's been placed in charge to take Paul to Rome. And so Julius, as you can imagine, was this very common name in the Roman Empire, naming after Julius Caesar. But also Paul's with a friend, isn't he, verse 2? He's with a friend called Aristarchus. And obviously you remember Aristarchus because he's mentioned in Acts 20, verse 4. It says as well, come up on the screen, he's called a fellow worker in Philemon 23. So a few slides on, John. He's called a fellow prisoner in Colossians 4, verse 10. And so Aristarchus, he's there to keep Paul company, but also to provide for Paul's needs. Prisoners weren't given three square meals a day then. They would have to find their own supplies. And so when Paul gets to Rome, when he's in custody, he's going to need someone like Aristarchus to be there for him. We hear about Paul in the letters, about providing blankets for him when he's in prison, to provide food and clothing, and that's what Aristarchus is there for. But I don't know if you notice someone else is travelling with Paul as well when we were reading. Someone else is travelling, and it's our author, Luke. Did you notice the language changed in verse 1 when it was decided that we would sail? So now Luke, our doctor, our historian, is now part of the story as well. He's been following this story about this man called Jesus, as we see in the Gospel of Luke, and then how the church has grown in Acts. And he's writing down all these details, he's interviewing people, and this has led him all the way to Paul himself, and now travels with him. And so Paul has these two friends, and they're in the port city of Caesarea. A picture of that should come up. There's Caesarea. They're in this port city, and they get a ship from Antrimidium, and that's where the ships come from. This boat from what is kind of near modern-day Istanbul, that's where they've got this boat from. And if you've got one of the church Bibles, actually, if you flipped over right to the very back cover, you have a map of Paul's missionary journeys. And one of those journeys you see on there is this journey to Rome. And again, if you bring up the next slide, John, you can see the map there. That's the journey they took. They travel about 70 miles to Sidon. And you see the centurion's kind enough to let Paul get off the ship and let Paul go off to see his friends. And you can imagine it in those days, it takes a few days, doesn't it, to offload and then put on again all the cargo in these different ports. So they have some time there. So Julius says, it's okay, you need to eat, you need to survive, go and see your friends and you can visit them. So that's kind, isn't it? And then they travel, it says verse 4, they pass to the lee of Cyprus. And again, which Lee is this talking about? Lee Mack? Lee Evans? Well, it's not a name. It says, past the Lee means they travelled on the protected side of the island. So if you've got it in your Bible there, or you see on the map there, they travelled, obviously, that side of Cyprus. They didn't travel in the open sea, they travelled that side. So that's what it means, to travel on the side of the island which is most sheltered from the wind. That's what it means. So that's what they do here. They travel near Cyprus, they say hi to Bob and Liz. And then they do it later too with Crete, don't they? They pass the lee of Crete. You didn't want to travel in the open ocean. You'd get some violent storms. You're hugging the coast. And if anything goes wrong, it means you're near ports. So you can go into those ports. And so verse 5 and 6, if you notice, they stop in the city of Myra. They board another ship to set sail for Italy. And we see that other ship they go on to, is from Alexandria, which is in Egypt. And we see it's carrying grain. Verse 38, when the storm comes, they throw all the grain out. And the boat's heading to Rome, carrying this grain, because Rome, historically, needed to import between 150 to 200,000 tons of grain each year. And the bread basket, the supplier, the Tesco of the day, was Egypt. And that's where this ship's from. So they're travelling slowly. The weather's not very good. And they eventually, verse 8, get to this port called Fair Havens. Which sounds nice, isn't it? I have to say, I agree with Paul here. I have to agree with Paul. If I had to stay somewhere for the winter, because of bad weather conditions at sea and things, staying in Crete in a place called Fair Havens sounds a pretty good idea, doesn't it? I wouldn't mind that. But they don't think it's suitable. So let's follow the story from verse 9. Much time had been lost, and sailing already had become dangerous because of, by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." But the centurion, instead of listening to Paul, to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship. Since the harbour was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbour in Crete, facing both southwest and northwest. You might be able to see that from the map as well, or in your Bible. Now, what Paul's concerned about is that it's too late in the year to set sail travelling again. They should stay in Fair Havens. And it's already gone past the time of the Day of Atonement. Now, he's not saying that for religious reasons. The Day of Atonement that year would have been in around October time. So he's saying it's not October, it's too late to sail. And so, according to sources, you would have wanted to stop travelling by sea by usually mid-September. And so here it's October, and Paul's saying, "I'm not too sure this is a good idea. We should stay in Fair Havens." But the centurion, Paul, remember, has travelled thousands of miles by boat so far because of all his travels. He knows what he's talking about. But the centurion listens to the ship owner and the captain, fair enough, and they say there's a better port in Phoenix, which is a bit further along in Crete, as you can see. So they set sail, and they're going to try and make it there to stay there for the winter. And then this is what happens, verse 13. When a gentle wind, a south wind, began to blow, they saw their opportunity. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before long, a wind of a hurricane force called a northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by a storm and could not head into the winds. So we gave way to it and were driven along. We passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda. We were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. So the men hoisted it aboard. Then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together because they were afraid they would run aground on the sandbars of Cyprus. They lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. So things have kind of gone from bad to worse. Their plan was to weigh anchor and start travelling to Phoenix. So weigh anchor, it kind of sounds like you let your anchors down, doesn't it? But it doesn't mean that. It means you lift your anchors up and they start sailing for Phoenix. But then verse 14, a wind of a hurricane force arises. The Greek word there for hurricane is the word typhonicus, which is where we get our word for typhoon. And they can't fight the wind. They're getting pushed out more and more to sea. And there's a series of desperate attempts to try and make sure they're not being blown off course, to make sure they're not being blown down south towards Africa, down south, verse 17, towards the Cyprus. And we all know what the Cyprus means, don't we? Now, what does it mean? Well, next picture, John. It's a stretch there of about 400 miles nearer the coast of Africa. And it's known there, you don't want to get into this area, because it's known there for having poor visibility, having strong winds, a place to have violent storms, large patches in that area of very shallow waters, and as a result, very few docks that you could go into if you were in trouble. They want to really be careful not to avoid being blown into this area. And so they try all sorts of things to avoid it. And you see there, the lifeboat on the side of the boat, so it was flapping about and from the winds, and it wasn't secure, so they bring the lifeboat into the ship. We see, don't we? It says, It says, verse 17, that they put ropes around the boats like that, under the boats, and wrap it around to stop the ship from breaking apart. Verse 17 as well, they lowered the sea anchor. Now we think when a ship docks, they lower the anchor to make sure it stays secure and stays where the ship is. But actually the sea anchor is kind of the anchor that you use to lower it, and it creates drag. It's like a brake in a car. It creates drag, stop them blowing off course. And the next day, we see they get rid of cargo and supplies. And we still know the weather is bad, because verse 20, they don't see the sun or the stars for many days. It's like springtime in Wales, isn't it? But they can't see the sun, they can't see the stars, they can't, which means they can't navigate. They can't tell where they're going from the stars. They can't see land because it's not sunny. They have no idea where they are. So this is the situation they're in. Verse 20, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. So let's continue the story. Verse 21. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice and not sailed from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some islands.'" Now, verse 21, they've gone without food for a while. We don't know if that's because of some kind of religious reasons from the sailors, but most likely it's just that they're seasick, isn't it? And perhaps they're so anxious and been so busy, they haven't had time to stop and think, let alone eat. And in the midst of all this, imagine the weather conditions on the boats going back and forth. In the midst of all this, Paul stands up and gives a speech to the soldiers and the sailors. And perhaps some people at this point think this is where the story is made up. Why would all these people, soldiers and sailors, suddenly listen to a prisoner like Paul on a ship? Well, you need to remember that Paul's very intelligent. He's a Roman citizen, so had certain rights. He's probably older, 50s, 60s, than a lot of people on the ship. And remember, from all Paul's journeys, he's been thousands of miles at sea, so he's no stranger to all this. And so he stands up. And firstly, it sounds like verse 21, he's giving a big, "I told you so, I told you so." Anyone think it was better to stay in Fair Havens? Anyone think that? Yeah, I did. But he's not trying to rub it in their faces. He's trying to say, "Look, I'm credible to listen to. I was right about this thing. Listen to me now. Look, I was right about not leaving Fairhaven. I was right about that. So listen to me now. An angel of the God that I worship appeared to me last night." And Paul says, and said, "Paul, God said you're going to make it to Rome. And so you are going to make it to Rome. And I believe the angel. And more than that, this angel told me you're going to be safe. Yeah, we'll lose the ship, but you're going to be safe. Believe this, believe this." The boat owner probably isn't too happy with that, but the sailors probably encourage. But they're not safe yet. They're still in the middle of this storm. So verse 27, look down. "On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved.' So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away." Now, here obviously they're drifting still, tossed by this storm, looking for some kind of land. And they think they're getting close. I don't know what told them that, but they think they're getting close. And so it says, doesn't it, verse 28, they took soundings Now that means that they took a rope or this cable with a lead weight at the bottom of it, dropped it into the sea, and to measure how close the bottom of the sea was. So firstly, it was 120 feet deep, wasn't it? Then 90, so they're getting closer to land. And so, verse 29, they drop four anchors from the stern, the back of the boat. And while all that's going on, perhaps while they're all looking at the back of the boat, seeing these anchors being dropped in, meanwhile, at the front of the boat, Paul sees some sailors trying to escape. They're pretending they're letting anchors down from the front of the boat, the bow, but actually they're letting the lifeboat down trying to escape. And kind of Paul shouts at them. He tells the centurion, look, if you want to survive, you need to stay on this ship. You need to stay here. And so let's see what happens next, verse 33. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. He broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Together there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. And so look, Paul's saying here, look, you need to eat something. You need to get your strength. And I think this is great because he's just said, look, God's told me you're going to be fine. God's told me you're going to be okay, but you need your strength. You need your strength, but God told me you're going to be all right. That's kind of like the Christian life, isn't it? It's like the Christian life. It's like we've had in our home group recently with Nehemiah. Nehemiah says, look, we're going to pray to God as a people. We're going to be protected. We're going to continue this work. We're going to pray to God that he will protect us. And we're going to put a guard on top of the wall with a sword as well. So which one is it? Do you believe in God to protect you? Well, yeah. Is he going to protect you? Yes, with this guard on a wall with the sword. And that's the Christian life. Paul says, look, you're going to be fine, but you need to build up your strength. And so Paul breaks bread there. It's not the Lord's Supper. He's praying for the food. He gives thanks. And then as a result, verse 36, then they're all encouraged to eat. And because they think they're getting closer to land, they throw the grain overboard. Now, almost done. Verse 39, almost done. We see, when daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. They hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and run aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get on planks or any other pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely. So you go. So the next day, the sun comes up. Finally, the sun comes up, and they see land at last, after over 2 weeks. And they try and do everything they can do to get there. So they cut off all the anchors. They raise this foresail to get the wind behind them, to get them to run aground. But before they kind of make it safely to run aground, they run aground on a reef, and they get stuck. So you can imagine it. The front of the boat is stuck on this reef, and then the back of the boat has just been pounded by the waves, and it breaks apart. And so everyone scatters. And the prisoners, perhaps thinking, I'll try and escape, the soldiers want to try and kill them so they don't escape. As a soldier, if you lose a prisoner, you lose your life. But once again, the centurion, Julius, he's kind, wanting to help Paul. He steps in, and all their lives are spared, and they either swim to the shore or they get pieces of the wreckage of the boat and they make it safely to the island, which next week we'll find out, spoiler alert, is Malta. Now, I've gone through all that. I'm sure after all that, how I've explained it, it feels like you're there, doesn't it? But perhaps at the beginning we were asking, and maybe you are asking more so now, why is this story here? It doesn't really seem to fit in with the rest of the book of Acts. Why is this story here? And that's the big thing we're going to ask. What's the big thing that this story is trying to tell us? What's the big thing this story is trying to tell us? Is it just a nice, adventurous story? I mean, we've just had Paul on trial for a few chapters, and maybe we've got a bit bored with that, and we want something a bit different, this exciting story about peril at sea. I mean, it would make quite a good film, wouldn't it? Or perhaps a Netflix series. Oh, I can't wait for the next episode. What happened to Paul and his mates? Well, as exciting as it is, I'm not sure that's why Paul wrote it. So why is it here? I mean, it's a long story. It's taken us over 20 minutes to get here. I'm aware how long I've spoken, don't worry, but what's the point? I mean, there are definitely themes throughout this that we could bring out some themes. Like one theme could be common grace. So common grace is because we're made in the image of God, everyone that despite sin, everyone can display kindness and love and creativity because we're made in the image of God. For example, Julius, he's not a Christian, but several times he shows kindness to Paul, doesn't he? He helps him out in verse 3, lets him go to his friends so he could be provided for. He saves Paul's life in verse 43. So a non-Christian like Julius, he's there. He's a decent human being. God's common grace. That's one theme. Perhaps another theme we could talk about is our author, Luke. And he's such a historian, isn't he? We can see here, there's nothing in this story with all the details that make us think this is just made up. No, these are real events. The small details here that Luke gives us, this is a real story. Now, there's many sub-themes that we could mention. I think they're worth thinking about, but they're secondary. And here's what I think the big point is, and the big point that this story is trying to tell us. I think the last verse gives us a clue. The very last sentence gives us a clue. The last sentence. In this way, everyone reached land safely. So this long story, with all its details, is trying to show us how everyone reached land safely. Why is it so important for Luke to show us that everyone got to land safely? Why is that important? Because God promised that they would. That's the big point. God keeps his promises. All the way back in chapter 19, Paul had this resolve, this determination. He said in chapter 19, I'm going to go to Rome. Then back in chapter 23, verse 11, God said, Paul, you're going to Rome, and if you're going to Rome, I'm going to get you to Rome. God has promised Paul that he will get to Rome. And God promised specifically, didn't he, that the whole ship, all the people on the boats would survive. Verse 22 of our passage, we see that, don't we? But now I urge you to keep courage because not one of you will be lost, only the ship will be destroyed. But God said, everyone on the ship is going to be safe, I promise. Same thing, verse 34. It says, not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. God had promised them, still in the midst of the storm, remember. He didn't say this when the weather was good. He said this when the waves were battering the boat in the bleakest moment. God promised, everything is going to be fine. You'll make it. And that is why Luke ends the chapter with, in this way, everyone reached land safely. The point is, God is true to his words. God promised that no one will drown, and what happened? No one drowns. He promised Paul that he would make it to Rome, and come what may, Paul is going to make it to Rome. And we might think, oh, that's great, this is a great story. It would make a great film. That in the toughest, bleakest circumstances, God kept that promise. But this story about a ship in a storm, what's this got to do with me? It's great seeing God's promise here. It's dramatic. It's powerful. But what's this got to do with me? Well, you know what? Today, if you're a believer, you and I, we have better promises from God. Brothers and sisters, we have better promises. Just think of just this series, this long series in Acts. Just think about the promises we've heard so far. Acts 2:21. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. That is a promise. If you call on the name of the Lord, even this morning, if you call on the name of the Lord, and it doesn't matter how bad you are, how far away you've been, what country you've come from, how many sins you've committed, if you call on Jesus' name, you will be saved. That is a promise. Acts 2:36, therefore, let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. That is a promise. This Jesus who suffered the cruelest, lowest death of crucifixion has now gone to the highest place. He's been given the name that is above every name. He is Lord. You can count on that because God has promised that. Acts 24:15. I have the same hope in God that these men themselves have, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. That is a promise. There is a promise of the resurrection, that whether you're Christian here today or you're not, there is a resurrection, just or unjust, righteous or unrighteous. Everyone here, everyone in Newtown, everyone in history will be raised in judgment. How do we know? God promised it. Do you believe in these promises? Do you take God at his word? That when you open up the Bible, perhaps if you're a Christian, if you open up the Bible throughout the week, are you looking, and the things that you read, are you looking, what is God promising me here? What is he promising me? There, God has promises in store for you here. This week, if you're wondering what to read, read the Beatitudes, Matthew 5. Read the Sermon on the Mount. There are promises for you there. Matthew chapter 5, verse 4, and this is apt for us at the moment. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. If you're mourning right now, go to that verse. Go to that verse this week. And then you go, God, you promised me there that when I mourn, that when I go through those times, that you will be with me. You will comfort me. Go to that verse. Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. How do you fight lust? How do you not go on that website on your computer? Because you believe the promise of God, that the pure in heart will see God. And you say, you go to that verse and you say, God, you've promised me that I will see you, and to see you is so much better than to see that. And so I'm going to believe your promise. I want to see you. You've promised that if I'm pure, I will see you who is pure. The Christian life is based on the promises of God, just as we've been singing. And now perhaps some of you, you feel like you're in a storm. You feel like Paul. You're lost at sea, bashed and thrashed by life. And that's the point of the text here, that in the midst of that storm, in the midst of all the craziness, in the midst of the waves and the chaos of your life, God has a plan and he knows what he's doing. That's the point. And so when we get those moments in life, when we're in that storm, we need to say, like verse 25, so keep up your courage, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. God gives us this crazy story to show us that no matter how crazy life is, everything will happen just as we've been told. That all our days, every single one of our moments are written in his book before we've even lived a day. Things will happen exactly as he says. And the point of this story isn't that you come away from thinking, Paul, this is great, Paul, you can be a hero just like Paul. Well, the point is, you know a hero like Paul is. Did you see what Paul did not do in the midst of the storm? Did you see what Paul did not do? What he doesn't do is what another man did in the midst of the storm. When Jesus was in the midst of the storm, he rebuked the storm. He rebuked the wind and the waves because he rules the wind and he made the waves. Paul doesn't think he's a hero. He knows a hero. He knows the one who rules the waves, who calmed the storm. Paul doesn't set himself up to be the hero. Do you remember? He just gathers all these frightened sailors and soldiers around. He gathers them around and says, look, What I know is this, the God who I worship says that we're going to be all right. And if God told me we're going to be all right, one thing I know is we're going to be all right. And so when you have choppy seas, feeling shipwrecked or drifting, find those promises of God this week and fight the fight of faith. It is a fight in those difficult moments, isn't it? We remember here, I'm finishing now, but we remember here, don't we? It's a great story. We know the end of the story. We know they're going to be safe, don't we? We know it's going to be all right. But when they were adrift at sea for 2 weeks, they didn't think so. When they were being hit by big waves, they didn't think they were going to be safe. Verse 20, we gave up all hope of being saved. We kind of get that, don't we? I don't know how I'm going to make it through this next week. I don't know how I'm going to get through this illness. We get those moments. And I'm going to tell you now, I don't know what the future holds for you. I don't know what this next week will look like for you. I don't have a special word from the Lord about your circumstances this morning. But one thing I do know is this. I know that God is a God of promise. And so find those promises in Scripture this week and throughout your life and fight with everything that you have to hold on those promises even when the storm is strong. So trust the promises of God. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you. His promises are sure, and he is the same today, yesterday, today, and forever. Amen.